Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and today I'm joined by Stephanie, Heather and Pat.
Hello.
Hi.
This week we're celebrating Winnie the Pooh Day by talking about books for the very young. We talked to the wonderful Craig Smith about creating characters children will love. Heather will be sharing her work in progress with us, and Pat and Linda will be telling us what's on their bedside table. Stephanie is not as happy as a clam today, but she's got some other little gems to share with us. But first, before Linda went on her travels, we managed to pin her down to record and name the novel. So, Linda is about to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay. This is the true story of a scientific discovery that, among other advances, played a very important role in the development of the polio vaccine, revealed previously unknown information about viruses, and cleared the path to gene mapping.
Ooh, interesting. I have no idea.
No.
Not a clue.
Is it a novel or fiction?
It's a true story that reads like a novel. Yeah. Clue two. So not only is this a story of scientific discovery, it's also the story of the invaluable contribution, albeit a contribution made without her consent, of a poor tobacco farmer in the American South.
No idea.
It's excellent. Yeah. Although 60 years have passed since the death of the tobacco farmer, and millions of dollars have been made from the reproduction and sale of the HeLa cells, her surviving family members have never received a cent, and in fact can't even afford health insurance for themselves.
Oh, that's shocking, isn't it? HeLa cells.
Right, that should give it to you. Mm. No?
I have no idea.
No, you've stopped us.
The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Sloot. You haven't heard of it?
You're just making this up now, aren't you?
You would say that.
Yeah, Teresa doesn't usually lose. But
I've never heard of it in my life.
Really? Oh, my goodness.
It must be an American thing.
It's an American book, but it's something that's interesting, I would think, the whole world around.
Absolutely.
Because of these cells. She went to Johns Hopkins. Henrietta Lacks, this woman, went to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. She had pain in her cervix, and doctors found this cancerous tumor. And it looked different when they took biopsies than anything they'd ever seen before. So they took samples of the cells, which was standard procedure, and they discovered that her cells could be kept alive and they could grow, something that had never happened before.
Wow.
And they're called the HeLa cells because it's the first two letters of her first and last name. And now those HeLa cells are used all over the world in medical research. There are more than 11,000 patents involving these HeLa cells.
So what you're saying, these cells that they took from her grew, and so they are the basis of any experimentation where they need living human cells. They use her cells.
Her cells. Her,
wow.
Her cells from her cancerous.
It makes me so mad that people don't have a basic sense of fairness.
Her
family should be benefiting from this. That makes me so cross.
There are now more than 11,000 patents involving the HeLa cells. It's a multi-million dollar industry that sells human biological materials. And her family was not aware of this until somebody came wanting to get more cells from her family members, and they didn't know what was going on.
Common base, no lawyer in America has taken it on. I mean, you'd think it's just a must-win case.
It's an incredible story and so well done. So I truly think that you would enjoy very much reading it.
And what was the author's name again?
The author is Rebecca Sloot. That's Sklout. The immortal life of Henrietta.
I think we'll all be seeking that out. That's wonderful. An amazing story.
And it's not a novel, but it reads like a novel.
Yes, so very well done. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
Now it's over to Heather for her work in progress.
This is a small piece out of what I hope will end up as a book. I've written about 5,000 words to outline the plot, and I've tried to play with a different style of writing than I usually use. So, hello stranger, I do hope you had a good Christmas. He sounded concerned and looked into her eyes, and she felt that he could see into her heart. I didn't get your number, I couldn't get in touch. She believed every word. He was sorry. He would have been in touch if he could. The tension that had built up over the holidays started to drain away. She felt the smile as it twitched at her lips. Do you fancy meeting up for a drink later? Although you'd better take it easy. If you were like a tiger last time, I could hardly keep up. That's not quite how she remembered it, but he cared, and he wanted to see her again. The sex was better the second time, but she felt no pleasure. She wasn't sure what to expect, but thought that surely it should be better than this. But she took it and tried to smile. He didn't say much and left with a wink and a wave. Can I ask you a huge favour? She would have said yes to anything. Being near him was all she wanted. Can I borrow your essay before you hand it in? He looked like an eager little boy. I just need a little help to get my thoughts together before I write mine. Of course you can. Anything for you, she thought. I'll help you every week if you like. Even to herself, she sounded desperate, and the routine began. She always gave him her work to look at. She explained how she worked out the topics to study. By the end of the second term, his marks had improved. He even did marginally better in the end-of-term exam. This time, he phoned her during the Easter holidays. Just once, but he called. I'm going away with my family, but I'll see you when we get back to uni, he promised. He was her world. Her small group of friends and her sisters told about their experiences with their boyfriends. She copied their words, too ashamed to tell the truth. She couldn't say anything to him. He might get cross, or worse still, leave her. She'd put up with anything to keep him. She only once complained that he'd hurt her. He'd stormed out of her room, banging her door on his way out. Flakes of plaster floated to the floor. He didn't answer his phone when she called to apologise. She didn't see him for a week. Why didn't I see what was happening? It had started to rain. She had to go. She couldn't stay out here any longer.
Mm. It is very different from your usual, isn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't realise when I looked at it that it was the start of a novel.
I've done the first chapter. I tried to do it in chapters, and I've tried to put sort of the first few lines is now, the now, and then she remembers what it was.
Mm.
And the start of it, she's in court and she's told she has to leave. And she goes outside and she sits on a bench and then she talks about how she met him and what happened. And this is kind of, she sat there saying, why did I do, why did I let this carry on? Mm-hmm. So that, and then this is the next bit.
Right. Well, I thought just on its own, it was really intriguing.
Exactly the word I used.
Absolutely intriguing, because you get the picture that she's either been in or is still in an abusive relationship, and it started to rain and she had to go. She couldn't stay out here for any longer. I was like, where is she? Outside his house stalking him? Where is she? What's doing that? I was completely. Yeah, I would have turned the page.
Yes, there's a lot of unanswered questions that draw you in and make you want to read on.
Mm.
I thought, I like the opening. It's very immediate, just starting with somebody speaking, no explanation.
Yeah.
And I think that's good, very dynamic. One of the things I wondered, nobody has a name in here.
Right.
And I wondered if that was intentional. I feel that I could relate to the protagonist a bit more if she had a name.
In the first chapter, a name's mentioned. What I've tried to do is do the she did this and she did that.
Right.
Mm.
An idea I've had.
You're playing around with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
She's called Hazel and he's called Nathan. But
right.
No, I liked it a lot. I thought it was fabulous.
Yeah, I did.
The point of view, I thought, was maintained. There are places when a couple of times I thought, oh, is that a point of view slip? But I think it's her inner dialogue. You know, when she believed every word, he was sorry, he would have been in touch if he could. You could think that was getting into his head, but actually I think that she's saying, oh, he's sorry, he would have been in touch if he could, you know.
Yes. So, and I think some of that is punctuation.
Yes.
No, it's me again.
No, but, you're absolutely right.
But yeah, that could be clearer, I think, with a little bit of...
Well, even I've noticed that I've missed out some punctuation that I know should be there.
Yeah.
But as I say, it was. I was quite nervous about sharing it because it's the first time I've tried sort of something that's out of my knowledge.
I think it's fabulous. Yeah. And I think for a kickoff, for something that, as you say, is a complete departure from anything you've done before, I think it's fabulous. I mean, I have come up with some ideas, but it's not really so much to criticise as just to say, well, here's a couple of ideas I had when I was reading it that might help to beef it up. Like, for example, he looked like an eager little boy. Given that he's a monster, I'd kind of like a less benign image.
Okay.
So an eager little boy is quite cute, isn't it? But what, I don't know.
But that is her perception. Well, isn't it? That's the point.
Well, yes, maybe so. It was just my thought was that there could be another image which had a little bit less,
possibly puppy dog or something like that.
Yeah, something that could turn nasty,
less human,
pushed. Yeah,
or you could describe in a way, you know, like when he's asking her to
help with his essay.
I opened his eyes, put his bottom lip out, so that from the reader's perspective, you can say, oh, he's putting that on, even though she doesn't necessarily see it. Maybe that would work.
It was just a thought. And I loved the flake of plaster floating to the floor when he slammed the door. But I thought that bit, that she'd only once complained that he'd hurt her, that it was a shock to me that he'd hurt her. And I wondered if that should come before...
Possibly.
She copied their words, too ashamed to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Which again I thought was a nice way of saying it.
And I wasn't sure.
I wasn't sure if that was physically or emotionally.
We don't know yet.
I don't know.
Well, I think the implication is that the sex is rough.
Yeah.
You know.
But you always think of things like that, Teresa.
I'm just reading. It's there. The clues are there, as we say. Yeah. But no, it's a strong idea, I think.
It is a strong idea. I would have,
you know, like what you were saying about copying the friends, we could you could have shown us a little bit. Mm-hmm. They said this and this and, you know, maybe.
Oh, yes, Nathan does that.
You know.
Wishing that he would.
Yeah.
Or, you know, something like that.
But then sometimes, depending where this is and the context of it, sometimes you don't want all that detail.
Mm.
No.
Yes, it's good to just have that, those hints and that outline. I think maybe.
And when you say she'd put up with anything to keep him, I think you don't need to tell us that because you're showing us that really, really well. You know that she's giving him her homework and that she's lying about her relationship and pretending he's like her friends and she's putting up with not being called all holidays and so on. I think it's fabulous. Mm. I'm looking forward to reading more.
Got a hell of a lot of potential.
Thank you. Heather, I think Nicola emailed you some comments.
She did. Yes, she said, a compelling little story. I find myself wondering about her background, parents, home life. Why was she so desperate for him? A boyfriend that she'd carry on with bad sex after the second time. This sentence was a bit confusing. Her small group of friends and her sisters told her about their own experiences with their boyfriends. She copied their words, too ashamed to tell the truth. I think I get it, Nicola says, but a bit more explaining or an example or two of the conversations might be good. A snatch of a conversation between her and a girlfriend, perhaps.
Okay.
I want to read more.
Okay. Yes. So, yeah, similar to...
Yes, we're all agreed on that.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing, Heather.
Thank you.
Stephanie, you've got something for us today.
I talked last time I did this part, I talked about all the things for happiness, but I'm not quite on the same tack today because I was thinking about all the different ways we talk about people dying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like 200 odd words in the English language to refer to people dying and phrases. In France, they
who knew?
In France, they call it, one of their euphemisms is somebody swallows their birth certificate. That's the French expression for dying. In Cuba, oh, they've moved to a face-up neighbourhood, which I think is quite good. And in Denmark, it's leaving your clogs behind.
Oh, yes. Well, we say popping your clogs as well.
We do. So
that's a pro.
I like that moving up market. That's
moving to an up-face neighbourhood.
Yeah.
I liked one from 1838, booked by the Gravesend bus. Don't know where that came from. Lay down one's knife and fork, that's from 1864. Go up Green River, 1872. I just thought I'd talk about three in particular that fascinated me. And the first one was carket, as in to cark. And the word cark, C-A-R-K, actually means to worry somebody or vex somebody, to make somebody anxious. But Antipodeans use the word cark to mean to die. But in fact, I think it's not spelt the same way. I think it's spelt K-A-R-K. And there are a number of theories of where to cark it comes from. One is that in Hindu, the word for death is kark. So it could actually be that it came from something to do with the occupation of India or something like that, from the Raj. But the Australian terms really came into use in the 1970s, and they're said to be derived from the cawing noises that are made by crows. You know, they go, cark, cark. And so an association with carrion and death.
Crows as harbingers of death.
Yes, and Castles, the dictionary of slang, says it does sound similar to croak. And obviously in the UK, to croak is also a slang term to die. So carking it, for all our Southern Hemisphere listeners, to cark, to peg it, to be brown bread. So that was the first one.
To join the choir celestial.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the first one I thought was quite interesting, to cark. And the other one was kick the bucket. We've all heard of this one, haven't we? And there are lots of theories about kick the bucket. Has anybody here got a theory about kicking the bucket?
I thought it was something to do with hanging.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's to do with hanging, because in a lynching or a suicide, somebody might stand on a bucket and then
they kick it away, don't they? And then hang
themselves. And indeed, John Baddock's Slang Dictionary in 1823 said that people hang themselves from a beam while standing on a pail or bucket, and that's where it comes from. But in William Shakespeare's Henry IV, there's a line where Henry IV says, "Swifter than he gibbets on the brewer's bucket." So it may be that brewer's buckets were used as scaffold.
Yeah.
But there are other theories. For example, there's a beam or a yoke that used to be used to hang things on in Norfolk, in farms. And if you were going to slaughter a pig, you would suspend it by its legs from this beam or bucket or yoke, and as you cut the animal's throat, it would struggle and kick the beam, thus kick the bucket. So it's in the throes of death, it was kicking the bucket.
Right. So the bucket is another word for the beam.
Yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah. And it's thought that comes from the French word trebuchet or bouc, meaning balance. So the beam and the balance. So so that's another theory, and also from the Catholic Church. After death, when a body was laid out, the holy water bucket was brought from the church and put at the foot of the corpse. And when friends came to pray, they would sprinkle the body with holy water. Now, I can't see that necessarily would mean death, because I would have thought if you weren't dead and you got cold water in your face, you might kick out and kick the bucket, but that would mean coming alive again. Yeah. But that's a fact that there were buckets.
It's maybe figurative because of the feet being...
Yeah, feet by the bucket, And the other one, again, was one that I thought I knew the answer to, which was about biting the dust. I thought that came from the Wild West, and where somebody died with their boots on, they would bite the dust, wouldn't they? Because they'd go down and with their face in the dust. But it's actually expressed in the Bible, the King James Version, which we all know is Linda's favourite. In Psalm 72, says that his enemies shall lick the dust. That's an expression that's used for when he overcomes his enemies. And in 1750, the Scottish author Tobias Smollett in Adventures of Gil Blas of St Elaine, which I've not read, said, "We made two of them bite the dust and the others betake themselves to flight."
Yeah.
So, again, it goes back to perhaps before the Wild West.
Teresa's probably read it.
Oh, I'm sure she has. Yeah.
I haven't read
Tobias Smollett's Adventures of Gil Blas of St Elaine.
I haven't read that one.
No, okay, but we'll add it to your Sudoku.
I will.
The other one was that the Iliad, which was written about 700 BC, has actually been translated into English. And in one of the translations, the Samuel Butler translation, there is a reference to biting the dust in talking about Hector, piercing Hector's shirt with a sword, that full many of his comrades may bite the dust as they fall dying around him. So, of course, that's a translation. But, you know, if there is a reference to biting the dust in literal terms, then that would actually put it as 8th century BC. So maybe not Wild West.
Interesting.
At all.
Very interesting. Well, if you're a classical scholar and you happen to know whether that is a verbatim translation, or a poetic translation, do let us know.
I'd love to know. And I'd also like to know about all the other wonderful euphemisms for death and dying, because there are just hundreds, and some of them are really funny.
In the hospital, we used to refer to going to Rose Cottage, and the euphemism for the morgue, which would be that she used to die to get there.
Is that a code so that if a patient or a family member overhears you?
It could quite well have started that way, yes.
Like in the theatre when you say, you know, Charlie's in the house, it means there's a fire or something like that, you know, without alarming members of the public.
There was a radio host who used to talk about people assuming room temperature. Some other you, which I quite like. Yeah. Oh, he's assumed room temperature.
Oh dear.
And of course, you know, we all know brown bread, don't we? Need brown bread.
Which
is the Cockney rhyming slang, which we've been trying to teach Linda endlessly. There you go.
Fascinating, Stephanie. Thanks very much. Well, this week, January the 18th, which is A.A. Milne's birthday, is also celebrated all over the world as Winnie the Pooh Day. Winnie the Pooh first appeared in print in 1926 together with his friends Piglet, Tigger, Eeyore and all the rest, based on toys owned by A.A. Milne's son, Christopher Robin. Some people will be going to Pooh Corner in Hartfield in East Sussex to play Pooh Sticks. Others will be having teddy bears picnics. All kinds of ways to celebrate Winnie the Pooh Day. We're talking about books for younger readers and creating characters that younger readers will love. As you all know, Winnie the Pooh was a very philosophical bear. I came across a quote that seems appropriate for us at podcast, which is, "You can't stay in your corner of the forest waiting for others to come to you. You have to go to them sometimes." My own personal favourite is, "People say nothing is impossible, but I do nothing every day." Before I ask Stephanie and Pat and Heather, Nicola has sent us in her thoughts on Winnie the Pooh and some quotes.
I didn't really read Winnie the Pooh as a child, but having flicked through some of their quotes online, I can see that he's an excellent way for a parent to teach children quite complex concepts sometimes. I like this one particularly. "I always get to where I'm going by walking away from where I've been." I think that means that you have to change who you are, change your environment, change your circumstances in order to move yourself towards the goals and the dreams that you have. This is a good one too for children who are a little bit different. "Piglet, the things that make me different are the things that make me." I like that one a lot. Teach children how to accept themselves. Here's a good one from Christopher Robin. "You're braver than you believe, stronger than you seem, and smarter than you think." I think the books are obviously going to stand the test of time because they've got some true lessons in them.
I think they did stand the test of time. Yes.
Nearly a century. But yes, very, very Nicola. Very goal-oriented. And, excellent.
Yeah.
So, Stephanie, do you have any favourite quotes?
Yes, I like Winnie the Pooh when he says, "Rivers know this, there's no hurry, we'll get there someday." That's quite a nice, gentle, laid-back way of being, isn't it? And the other one that I like Mainly because I'm quite tall and I was always the biggest in everywhere. Just because an animal is large, it doesn't mean he doesn't want kindness. However big Tigger seems to be, remember he wants as much kindness as Roo. So don't misjudge. Don't judge books by their covers.
And be kind to Steph.
Be kind to me.
And be kind to Steph.
Particularly when you're critiquing me. But I did just want to mention something else. There was a very famous professor of Carnegie Mellon University called Randy Poe. She's no longer with us. He is dead as a dodo, brown bread.
He's walked off this mortal coil.
He once said to his students, "You just have to decide if you're a Tigger or an Eeyore." And much as I love Eeyore, we all know people who are like Eeyore, don't we? Really pessimistic, negative, and they do drag you down. And I would much rather be a Tigger than an Eeyore any
but
day.
I do love Eeyore.
Yeah.
I love Eeyore.
Well, this is apparently from the opening chapter of the first Winnie the Pooh book, before the bear was called Winnie the Pooh. So it is, "Here is Edward Bear coming downstairs now, bump, bump, bump on the back of his head behind Christopher Robin. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming downstairs. But sometimes he feels that there really is another way, if only he could stop bumping for a moment and think of it." And my husband had that in a frame in his office.
Yeah. That's excellent.
Yeah, like Nicola, I never read Winnie the Pooh as a child. I didn't discover him until university. I think so. I was 17, 18 when I discovered Winnie the Pooh.
But he does have that appeal, doesn't he? That, you know, yes. Lots of people that read as adults.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I've chosen three very writing-related quotations as my favourites. And the first one is, "My spelling is wobbly. It's good spelling, but it wobbles, and the letters get in the wrong places." And I've known lots of people like that, but they've been very nice people. And then the next one, "You can't help respecting anybody who can spell Tuesday, even if he doesn't spell it right." But spelling isn't everything. There are days when spelling Tuesday simply doesn't count. And the last one, "Eeyore was saying to himself, 'This writing business, pencils and whatnot, overrated if you ask me. Silly stuff. Nothing in it.'"
Good old Eeyore.
I don't think Eeyore could hold a pencil. I think it was a bit of sour grapes.
Well,
then.
Maybe.
Bless him.
You say about teenagers, we were camping one time and we used to read Winnie the Pooh to the children all the time. And we were reading out loud to them in the tent, and both the children went to sleep. And so we stopped, and there were three teenage boys in the tent next to us said, "Oh, don't stop, we were listening."
That's great. That's great. You can even get Winnie the Pooh in Latin, can't you? And then, yeah. Imagine the person that's buying that, you know, somebody with a very traditional education and, you know, interesting, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, certainly a character that stood the test of time.
Yeah.
Well, when I mentioned to my daughter that we were talking about books for very young children, she said, "Don't forget Boggler Bill, Burglar Bill." And my kids certainly loved all the Janet and Alan Arlberg books, but Burglar Bill was a favourite. The Jolly Postman is perhaps one of their better known ones, and the Happy Families that we loved, based on the card game. But very comic books, beautifully illustrated. I think Janet was the illustrator in that couple. Do you have any favourite?
Well, certainly my grandchildren, the Hungry Caterpillar.
Oh yeah,
And Gruffalo. They're that kind of generation, and I do enjoy a lot of the Julia Donaldson books in their own right. Yeah. The stories of the Tiger Who Came to Tea. That's been another.
Yeah.
Another story when they've been, you know, preschoolers. Mm-hmm. But I think these days a lot of children are attracted to Peppa Pig and characters they see on the television.
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because they will. If it's encouraging them to pick up a book, then who cares really where they get to know these characters? But I remember Pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert, Dibble and Grub. You know, and that was television.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Wooden Tops and Pinky and Perky and so on. Mm-hmm. But no, it's nice if you can get them picking up books. Yeah. So.
Andy Pandy.
Yeah.
And I discovered a book, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago,
which I absolutely loved, a book for young children. It's called I Really Want to Eat a Child by Sylviane Donio. And it's about a baby crocodile who wants to eat a child, and the parents try everything to tempt the baby crocodile to have sausages. But that's a brilliant book. Originally, I think it's translated from the French, but I'd recommend that if you've got small children.
One of my favourites, and I was introduced to this through a school assembly, and it was one of my colleagues who took assembly, and he had small children, and he introduced us to Not Now, Bernard, which was a picture book with just a few words. And Bernard kept trying to tell his parents about various things, and they were always too busy, and so every page, every couple of pages was, Not Now, Bernard, mm-hmm. Not Now, Bernard. And it finishes off, you know, with the monster.
Yeah.
And you see the monster standing there and the parents going, Not Now, Bernard. And it's just lovely.
Yeah.
It's very, very funny.
And a warning, don't ignore your children.
Well, that was by David McKee.
Well, going back to the Winnie the Pooh books, and my favourite character is Eeyore, and I particularly loved Eeyore as lugubriously voiced by Willie Rushton back in the day in on the BBC, the old BBC series. He was a bit bipolar, Eeyore. He was a bit gloomy, wasn't he? And another great donkey character is Wonky Donkey. See what I did there? Little segue.
Yeah, well done.
Professionalism.
Yeah, that'll be the day. Wonky Donkey came to international attention. It was already selling very well, bestseller in New Zealand and Australia. But it came to international attention after a YouTube video of a Scottish grandmother reading it to her grandson went viral. And do look that up. It's absolutely brilliant. But Stephanie and I were lucky enough to get the chance to interview Craig Smith, the author, just before Christmas. And here's the interview that we recorded.
We are excited to welcome Craig Smith, author of several books and songs for small people, including Wonky Donkey and We'll Be the Bumblebee. Welcome, Craig. Thanks for talking to us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Craig, you're in New Zealand, but we came across you because of the YouTube video of a Scottish granny who was reading Wonky Donkey to her small grandson and was helpless with laughter. That's quite a skill to get grown-ups as invested in your characters as the kids. Where do you get your inspiration from?
Well, I do a few writing workshops with kids, and I always talk about the fact that if you are a writer, then the filter that you have as a writer filters just about everything. Everything you see and do and hear and watch gets filtered through the writer's viewpoint. The inspiration doesn't come first. The writing comes first. And so if you want to become a writer, you need to start writing, and that takes a little bit of discipline and maybe sitting down for even just 2 minutes a day, but sitting down every day and trying to write something. And then after a while, you become a writer, in the purest sense of the word. And then, of course, just about everything gets through. So you might watch something on TV, or you might hear a joke, or you might see something with your own eyes. And the first response is the same response for everyone. And then you put it through that writer's filter, which is, can I write about it? So just about everything I see and do or hear or witness goes through the filter of can I write about it? You know, so it doesn't take a lot because everything inspires me to write. And then I try and work, well, no, that's not a good idea, or that's a good idea. So that's why, for example, with Wonky Donkey, I just heard a joke, what do you call a donkey with three legs, a Wonky Donkey, and of course, and then I thought, oh, yeah, I can work with this, definitely. So another one I've written is called Square Eyes. I had a young nephew of mine who I told maybe he shouldn't be watching so much TV on a beautiful day, been watching for 3 hours already from 9 till about 12. And I said, well, we're going to go down to the beach. Do you want to come? He said, no. And I said, you'll probably get square eyes if you watch too much TV. And he said, well, why don't you write a song about it? I went away and did. And then turned into a book, which was the number one selling kids book when it was released here in New Zealand. So, yeah, everything goes through the filter. So that's quite a long-winded explanation of what happens. But basically everything goes through the filter, and that's how I get inspired. I'm a musician primarily. I write all my stories in song. And then what happened was I was writing for the more mature, shall we say, and then I got stuck inside on a rainy day with the young ones, and I started to write for the little ones, and I found I enjoyed it and loved their responses. And, you know, when you've got little ones saying, play it again, it's a lot of fun when, you know, you've struck the right chord with the little ones. And, you know, then I realized that I could help inspire them to get motivated about music, and I could also inspire them through those stories being turned into books, to pick books up and start reading. The books are really, really well known, obviously, now, but I write all my stories in song. And so people are able to download any of the music, and word for word, the lyrics of the song are also the words of the book. So what I've the response I get from parents who are traveling, and they either put the CD in the car, or they download, you know, on their iPod or whatever, and plug it into their car. It's really, really good, because it allows the kids to who know the stories to sing along to the stories while they're traveling. This is what I really like. This is sort of accidental with my work, but after years and years of doing it, I've had time to talk to people and think about what my style of work, which is basically storytelling and song, which has been around for a long, long time, way longer than reading. I had one lady come up to me and said, "Oh, I do like your work, but it's not very traditional. You know, I like the traditional children's books." And I said, "Well, actually, the new kid on the block is writing and reading, because probably absolute maximum, you would say, people have been, like across the board, most people have been reading and writing for, say, no more than 200-300 years. I mean, the first monks were probably writing about 1,000 years ago, but that was only a few people. And since the Gutenberg press, that changed everything, of course. But so I'm combining the old style of storytelling, which is song and even dance, with the new, which is the written word. And what that allows is those children who are a bit more oral learning, they can listen to the story. Those kids who are a bit more visual can pick the book up and read it and look at the pictures. And those kids who are a bit more kinesthetic, a bit more movement orientated, can have a bit of a boogie and have a bit of a movement while reading the story. All three of those learning styles sort of contained in the book. So that really allows children of different styles to then pick up reading easier.
And also the pre-readers, you know, the three-year-olds, you know, I mean, I have a three-year-old grandson. I just know he's going to love it, because he's got everything that he needs, and the repetition of words and the rhyme and the rhythm.
And you'll find he doesn't know how to read yet, but if he listens to the music a lot, he'll know when to turn the pages. He'll know how it'll even look like he's reading. And so that's what my daughter does. And she can't read the words yet. She's 3.5, but she knows exactly where to turn the pages, and it looks like she can read. Now, then a lot of people go, "Oh, that's not very good." And I said, "No, what you don't understand is that she has the confidence now to pick up books." That's the big first step, is do kids feel like they want to pick up a book? And my daughter absolutely does, and I've had that response from many, many parents. It's sort of an accidental thing, because I'm primarily a storyteller, musician at heart, but the author sort of side is just a very small step. At its heart, it's just storytelling. It really doesn't matter how you get that story across, whether it just be in a book or in music or in dance or whatever, but primarily we're storytellers, and that's where it is. The Aboriginal dances date back to you know, like in Australia, 40,000 years old, they think.
Wow.
Some of those. That's a long time to be telling a story.
Can I ask you something, Craig? Yeah. Have you had any contact with the lovely lady in Scotland?
Oh, yeah. Now, so she lives in Queensland, Australia.
Oh, really?
And so she has lived there for a long time, but she hasn't lost her accent. She's from Ayrshire in Scotland.
Same as my mum.
Really? They probably know each other. She's a lovely lady, and She was a bit taken back by all the fame. Do you know she got flown to New York? Did you know that?
No, no.
She got flown to New York and asked us to read Wonky Donkey at the Barnes & Noble flagship store in downtown New York.
Wow.
She got, like, earlier today I was down south in a place called Invercargill, which is in New Zealand, and I drove up to Dunedin, which is a three-hour drive. And Invercargill is at the bottom of New Zealand. It generally doesn't have very good weather. It's very flat. It's sort of an industrial-y town where it's a farming town. Mm-hmm. And so the joke that I have is that Janice Clark may have got flown business class to New York, but I got to go to Invercargill in my hiace.
Great. Absolutely.
So that's the running joke. So she's doing all the fame and stuff, but she's a lovely lady. And, you know, at its heart, you know, what that music, that video that she did, or that her daughter did, that's had over 100 million views now. Wonky Donkey currently is selling around 100,000 copies a week around the world. It's just incredible. And what it comes down to is a grandmother decided to read her child a story. So and it's such a great story in itself. Aside from people loving my story, which is great, the story of her doing what she's doing, just reading her grandson a children's book and laughing, is another great story on top of that. So you'll be very lucky that her daughter, Fiona, decided to video that, because without Fiona's foresight, that wouldn't have happened either.
Yeah. Tell us about how you actually got the books on the shelves in the shops. I mean, you said you were a musician and you wrote songs, but then they became books. Can you talk us through that journey?
Yeah, so originally I was writing stories and song. Now, if you think about some of the great story writers in song, like Cat Stevens or James Taylor or Leonard Cohen, they tend to tell, Harry Chapin was another favourite of mine, they tell amazing stories in song. And ideally, you know, those songs are usually between 3 and 4 minutes long, although some of them are a little bit longer. And that was when I started writing stories and song for kids. You know, it's the sort of the perfect length, those 3 or 4 minute long reading or songs for a children's book. And it wasn't long before it dawned on me that some of these stories and songs could be turned into books. So I approached several publishers and got rejected by all of them. Yeah, it's the same story over and over again, isn't it? What happened was one of my songs, which is Wonky Donkey, ended up winning New Zealand Children's Song of the Year, and that gave me the ammunition to refloat it with a couple of other publishers, and one in particular, which was Scholastic. I ended up finding out where the editor was going to be for a charity event, and I attended that charity event. But then what I did is I pretty much cornered her and asked her if she had a CD in her car, and she did. And I said, could you put the CD in the car on the way home? This is the first song on the CD, won New Zealand Children's Song of the Year, and I think it could be a book. 2 weeks later, she said she was going to add it to the acquisitions meeting that they had at Scholastic. And about 2 weeks after that, I was told, yeah, we would like to turn this into a book.
Wow. So the creative thinking on your part, ambushed the editor. That's pretty cool.
<Yeah. laughs> So going through the front door, the traditional means didn't work for me, so I had to sort of get creative and go through the back door, as it were. But I was touring the music for years. So as a musician, as a children's musician, I was touring the music since 2004. I had written Wonky Donkey in 2005. It won New Zealand Children's Song of the Year in 2008 and got turned into a book in 2009. Mm-hmm. So I was touring the stories and song as a troubadour, if you will, going around from school to school and playing children's music for a good 5 years before the books came out.
But I guess then when the book appears in the local bookshop, there's recognition from the children.
Absolutely, and from the parents. I used to go and play at a market every Sunday. And when the book came out, I had this book on display and, I was singing the song, and parents who had come down to market specifically with their children to listen to my music all of a sudden saw this book there, and they were super excited to be able to buy it as a book. you know, I was selling out regularly at those gigs, and so I had a fan base already, of course. So so that really did help launch the book, and the first 3,000 sold out within 2 or 3 days. So the first print run sold out immediately, and they did a reprint of the second 3,000. And then they soon realised all that did was fill the back orders that people had already pre-purchased. Right.
Wow.
And so then the third print run was around 12,000, and because they knew that they would have to. And we're not talking big numbers here, but that was just the precursor to really what was going to happen. And so it's quite funny because it's very similar to what's happening internationally now. Between Australia and New Zealand, over the last 9 years, Wonky Donkey has sold over 700,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And it was the number one selling kids book in Australia and New Zealand for over a year. Mm-hmm. And it was the number one selling book across all genres for 3 weeks in New Zealand. Wow. So it was outselling Stieg Larsson's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And it was outselling the millennial thing. When it first came out, that's what was happening. Mm-hmm. So what's happening now internationally had already happened on a national level. And it always baffled me why the book was so successful in New Zealand but never really overseas. But, of course, Janice Clark, the Scottish granny, took care of that for me and by reading my book and laughing her head off. So it just was the perfect promotional platform, as we know. That video's had over 100 million views in the last 12 weeks. So it's just an author's dream, really, to have, have that happen.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Are you working on anything at the moment, a new book?
Yep, I'm working. I've just released a brand new book called The Drizzly Bear. That's about a bear who can't get to sleep because there's a hole in the roof and the water keeps dripping on his head, and one drips in his belly button and another one on his feet and another one up his nose, and he just can't seem to get to sleep or have a doze. But the book's actually released, so that's one that's actually done. But it's only been out for about a month.
Mm-hmm.
But in the story, when I'm playing the music, I interrupt it with the dripping, and I and it really, the kids love it, and they're like, "How are you doing that?" And it's just a little trick that I learned years ago. And so when I do it, it really captures them. And I talk about the fact that. That the drip is a bit of a metaphor for things that may keep you awake at night. In the end, the teddy bear, he wears his raincoat instead of pajamas, and he gets his umbrella out and hides under his umbrella, and then he falls asleep. And I tell the kids that my umbrella, when things are trying to keep me awake at night, is I take my pen and paper and I write all my things that are keeping me awake on a piece of paper, and that gets them out of my head and allows me to go to sleep. And, of course, we all know that when you have a better good night's sleep, that obviously things are better the next day. And the double-edged sword of that when I'm talking to the kids is the fact that then once their issues are written down on a paper, maybe a mum and dad can pick that paper up and find out exactly what it is that's keeping that child awake at night. Yeah. So it's a cute book with a funny storyline, but there's a deeper meaning. Well, I'm working on... one called Wonky Donkey's Paralympics, which I've been working on for over a couple of years. So Wonky Donkey he's got a missing leg, of course, as we know. He's a wonky donkey, and one of his eyes missing. So I was watching the Paralympics a few years ago, and I was incredibly inspired by these people. We have the world's fastest runner for someone who doesn't have any legs. His name's Liam Malone. He's the world's fastest Paralympian. And he can run 100 metres in under 10.9 seconds. And it's incredible for someone who hasn't got any legs to run at all, let alone in 10.9 seconds, which is Olympic qualifying time. And, of course, this New Zealand connection with that 100 metre sprinting, I got in touch with the Paralympic Committee. They were extremely excited to have me on board. And I wrote a story about how Wonky gets inspired by watching the Paralympics and decides to have a games day at the park and inviting all his friends. And they have a competition, and he enters his favourite race, which is the 100-metre race, and up until one point he's winning the race, and then his leg falls off, and he starts to lose the race, But of course, we know Donkey has a massively big heart, but what he's famous for is his ability to fart, and he farts himself across the finish line in first place. So I didn't want it too respectful and so to the point where we lose any humour.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to be so silly that it was disrespectful. So I feel like I've been working on it for a couple of years now and playing it over and over and over to kids and getting responses from people who are paralysed or not, you know, people who are able-bodied but found the story funny but still respectful, et cetera. So I think we've got a really good balance. So that's what I try and do. I try and mix. It's very Shrek-y in that way. You know, the Shrek movies were very similar. Yeah. Yeah. And I remembered watching the Shrek movies and thinking, you know, this is how I write. It's, I try to have adult humour or humour that adults can have a good giggle at as well as the kids.
Without condescending.
Without condescending, exactly. Yeah. And actually the sort of puns that I do have, they sort of can be a little bit over the top of some kids' heads. But some of them get it. And so then they're explaining it to their friends who don't get it. So those ones who do get it, makes them feel a little bit special.
Yeah.
But also you're not talking down, as it were, to kids. You're sort of allowing them to rise up to the humour. And, of course, I even get some parents miss the humour that I have in some of my jokes. So it's fun when everyone starts to have a laugh, and that's the whole idea. If the parents are laughing, that gives permission to the children that they can have a laugh as well too. So it's easy for them to get involved in the book that way.
Oh, Craig, that's been so uplifting. It's such fun.
I'm glad. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity to have a chat. All right, ladies. All right, team.
A delightful man.
He was. What fun it was. He was great fun. Great fun. And I've read Wonky Donkey and I can't stop laughing either when the honky tonky winky wonky donkey.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Be very careful.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Pat and Linda to tell us what's on their bedside table. Over to you, Pat.
Okay, well, mine is quite accidentally, actually, very appropriate for the overall theme. It's a book called Bookworm by Lucy Mangan, and it's subtitled A Memoir of Childhood Reading. Lucy Mangan is a features writer for various newspapers, The Guardian, The Telegraph, but apparently she does work on radio and so on. And I've always liked her pieces whenever I've read them. And I was in that sort of like downtime where I had nothing that I particularly wanted to read. And I just read a piece in the paper. I thought, I must see if she's written something. And I looked on Kindle and I found this one. And she is a self-professed bookworm. Actually, I think obsessive reader might be more accurate. And in the book, she basically charts her own life as a reader, looking back at the books that she loved as a child. But she also contextualises many of them and includes fascinating details about many of the authors, critiques and analyses some of them and puts them into sort of like a historical context. And it's just a delightful book. I mean, I chose it because I enjoy her writing. I find her very funny. But it's often very interesting. And it would actually be an excellent read for anybody with young children who wanted advice on what to give them to read. And what I find fascinating and quite mind-boggling, to be honest, she still has most of her books.
Mm.
And she has read hundreds, thousands and thousands of books, and she keeps them all.
Mm-hmm.
But I just
she must have a very big house.
I don't know. But I have to read this one quotation, which just made me laugh out loud. Although she lives in London and she was basically brought up in London, her parents came from Preston, I think, and a grandmother lived in Preston and they used to spend holidays there. And I think that kind of informs basically her take on life and her style. But I just loved this. As a family, we practiced a sort of non-rugged individualism. We were thoroughly schooled in manners, ignored if we cried, absent free-flowing wounds or splintered bones. Intimidated into a healthy respect for our elders. And if you wanted to express yourself via any medium other than grammatically sound conversation held at a reasonable volume, you are best advised to try it elsewhere.
Excellent.
I love that.
That sounds like a very entertaining read, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So it's a great book, great read.
Oh, no. Also, it's another one I want to read.
Yes. I just say one of the fascinating facts, Enid Blyton once explained in correspondence with a psychologist who was researching writers' creative processes how it was that she could produce such astonishing amounts of material. She described having her characters always walking and talking in her head and needing only to look in on their dialogue and actions for her next story. It was, she said, simply a matter of opening the sluice gates and out it all pours with no effort or labour of my own. That's why I can write so much and so quickly. It's all I can do to keep up with it, even typing at top speed.
Hater. Open the sluice gates.
There you go.
Oh, well, that is fascinating. Thank you. Okay, and now we're going to hear from Linda.
On my bedside table right now is a really interesting book called Can You Ever Forgive Me? Memoirs of a Literary Forger by Lee Israel. Lee Israel was a biographer, having written successful biographies of Dorothy Kilgallen and Tallulah Bankhead. Actually, she was on the New York Times bestseller list for 1 week. But she then wrote a poorly received bio of Estee Lauder, and her luck ran out. She ran out of money, was on and off welfare, and according to friends and herself, she had a temperament and personality that made her totally unsuitable to work with other people. She got the idea of forging letters from celebrity writers. I won't go into the particulars here, but she began writing these terrific letters from Noel Coward, Dorothy Parker, Louise Brooks, Hemingway, many others. They were very funny and gossipy and absolutely true to character. She did so much research. And she sold more than 400 of these over a year and a half, using old typewriters from secondhand stores and cadging old weathered paper from the backs of journals and libraries. She was so good at it that two of her Noel Coward letters wound up in a book about him published by Alfred Knopf. And now the book is a film starring Melissa McCarthy. It's very funny. And Lee Israel doesn't seem to be the least bit remorseful. In fact, she says these letters were some of her best writing. Here's an excerpt that will tell you a little about her temperament and unsuitability to work with others. She started making, prank phone calls to people. She says, "The AA crowd calls it drinking and dialing. A plethora of people had ceased to return my calls. Important people in publishing and media. Loaded up, usually on gin, and adoring my own larkiness, I telephoned somebody who was once my buddy but was now in meetings all the time. I'd make a second call with just a slight change in attitude and voice, identifying myself often as Nora Ephron. The erstwhile conferee would come on in a thrice, usually with a warm, 'Hiya, Nora,' whereupon I shouted, 'Bleep, bleep, is that one word or two?' and hung up." She said, "Eventually I received a letter from Ephron's lawyer. Then two detectives came to my apartment. They used words like harassment. 'Well,' I said, 'if she can't take a joke.'" I have to say, all through the book, she doesn't express any remorse for what she's done. It's just a really incredibly funny book. Some reviewers have complained that this is a criminal who made her money doing bad things, and why are we participating by buying the book? But apparently they had already bought it and read it, and so did I, and it was hilarious. I really recommend it.
Well, sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered where you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review. Or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. We'd love to see our family grow in 2019. So do please introduce a friend to Write Club the podcast. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.